Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. This is your host and creator, Jason Herbert. And every single week, we are bringing to you conversations about history and film and film and history and everything else under the sun. And the movie we're talking about this week is A Christmas Story, a movie that I know a lot of you love, some of you hate, and very few of you have very small feelings about entirely. So this week, we've got an amazing scholar to introduce you to. I'm talking about Fawn Joy. She is a doctoral student at University College London, and she's actually writing her dissertation about Christmas films and some really interesting takes on Christmas films and how they fit into American and world history in general. It's a really interesting, amazing conversation that I had, really opened some eyes, my eyes, to a lot of things that I'd really kind of taken for granted. And we're going to talk about this movie, but we're also obviously going to answer some big questions about other Christmas films like Die Hard. We're going to talk about It's a Wonderful Life and a whole slew of other things. This is a really amazing conversation with a really phenomenal scholar. I think you're really going to love this conversation. So sit back and relax, because Our Christmas Story is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Hey, Fawn Joy, how are you?
Hi, Jason. I'm good. How are you?
It is earlier in the day than where you are. It looks very nighttimey where you are right now.
It is very nighttimey here. It is 8 p.m. here, but the sun set about 4.5 hours ago, so it has just been dark forever.
Can I tell you, you are the second person from England that I've spoken to today, or spoken to in England today. I just got through talking to Waitman and Bourne, who's up at Northumbria.
Yeah.
And we were talking about some different stuff we were going to do. And so my entire internal clock is completely whacked out because all I do is think that it's completely dark. And it's like 1 o'clock over here right now. It's completely fine. We have like 2 more hours of light time here in Colorado.
Yeah, you have some natural light. I have about 4 different lights going on in this room right now.
Oh my gosh. So when I was at Minnesota doing my doctoral work, I wasn't prepared for the seasonal depression there. And it was really difficult. And people kept saying, oh, you've got to go get these artificial lights so you feel better. And I'm like, I thought that's what the alcohol was for. But, you know, we all handle the light change in our own way. So anyway, I am so happy that you were here tonight. Like, I've been following you now on Twitter. Are we all about to get off of Twitter? Alex Jones is on Twitter.
Yeah,
like,
I saw. God, I don't know. I keep saying I'm going to leave, but it really is an addiction. I can't just switch to Blue Sky. It doesn't, or Blue Ski, as I like to call
right.
it. It's just it's not a better interface. I just enjoy Twitter too much more. I can shitpost all over Twitter and people enjoy it way more. Blue Sky feels more academic. It feels like I have to be professional there.
Blue Sky's where the grown-ups hang out. And I'm like, am I in the right room here? Because I don't know that I belong there yet either.
Yeah, I'm not ready for that.
And I was talking to Kevin Cruz today about this, right? Because Kevin was like the biggest historian on Twitter. And he had 450,000 followers. And he was talking today. He's like, yeah, I just left. He's like, I just gave it up. And I get it, right?
Yeah.
Kevin's in a different position of a career than I am.
Yeah, I was going to say. he can really afford to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's all right. I guess he's doing okay for himself. But, but.
Yeah, also, well, relative to. Like, I haven't even finished my PhD yet. I still need to pretend that I have some influence in order to get a job.
Oh my gosh, what are you even doing on this podcast? You should be writing right now.
I should be, actually.
Okay, that's awesome, because I so want to talk about your work. You're actually the very first graduate student we've had on the podcast.
Oh, and this really? Is something,
yeah. It's actually really near and dear to my heart, too, because I really want to use this pod in a lot of ways to talk to younger scholars, people who are doing the work. I mean, really, on the cutting edge of the work, but also, to say, hey, here's an awesome scholar. And I've been following you for a while, so I think you're the shit.
Thank you.
To say, hey, people should follow Vaughn, not only for the shit posting, but for the actual, for the scholarship and just the general awesomeness. So
thank you.
I'm really happy you took the time to be here tonight, I guess, even though it's 1 o'clock over here where I'm at.
I am grateful for you asking and having me on and for being the first grad student. That's really cool.
Well, let's jump into a couple different things before we jump into this movie. We're talking about A Christmas Story today, which is loaded, at least for me, but we'll get into that here in a little bit. Let's introduce you and your work to our audience. Can you tell us who you are and what you're doing here?
Yes. So I am a PhD student, as we have said, at the University College London, UCL. I study Christmas films, which is shorthand for, it's the fun shorthand. What I actually study is kind of the government's infiltration of Hollywood in 1947 and 1948 through various federal means. There's HUAC, the FBI, Supreme Court, lots of different influences going on in Hollywood, and then the kind of like Hollywood executive level, the elites making decisions for the filmmakers that really compromised the kind of social and cultural outputs that were being made and put a lot of pressures in many ways, but like primarily through the blacklist, pressures on those filmmakers to kind of conform to a specific ideology in their films. And I analyzed that cultural, the reverberations of all of those federal influences and pressures on Hollywood through a case study on Christmas films from 1946 to 1961.
Holy shit, this got way deeper and darker than I thought it would be.
I know.
Yeah. I was like, oh, hey, everyone, go wrap your presents now. This is fun. This episode's going to be out on December 20th. So that'd be, no, it
was good. No, that's the wrong vibe. If that's the vibe you're here for, put something else on until you're ready for this.
Oh, hell no. We're dogging. You're never going to enjoy a Charlie Brown Christmas ever again now that we're talking about this.
Yeah.
Did you go to UCL specifically with this, or is this a project that you decided that you like developed as you were at UCL?
So I used to be a classicist and I studied demonology in ancient mythology and literature, specifically around the reproductive issues that women have or people with uteruses had in the ancient world and how they explained them away with myths of like demon attacks and things. So that's where I started. And then I went to UCL for a second master's in history and studied comic books with classical influences in them. And I figured out that what I actually really cared about was this post-war period and thinking about the kind of pop culture choices that aren't respectable sources, quote unquote. So that got me to thinking about the PhD and what I actually wanted to do and using that kind of idea of classical reception, of building on mythologies to create new things for the modern era, which is what that comic book thesis was about, and trying to think of an innocuous kind of genre, something that you don't expect political messaging or even intense messaging of any kind. It doesn't have to be straightforwardly political, but trying to think of a source base for that. And the least studied one is Christmas films. And I happen to just love Christmas films from the period 46 to 61. So yeah, it all kind of came together that way.
This is awesome because I also love Christmas films. I've never thought about them in terms of like a 15-year time period. But also I think that most of the films that I grew up with, you know, I was born in the late 70s. So, you know, the time when I was watching Christmas movies was like in the 1980s. So I have to imagine most of those films that I was watching, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer stuff, the Charlie Brown stuff, that was all being produced maybe shortly thereafter. I would guess what, 60s and 70s is probably when that was coming out.
Yeah, Rudolph is 64. How the Grinch Stole Christmas is 66. A lot of the Rankin Bass stuff is late 60s, early 70s. And that's like Hollywood isn't really producing Christmas films between 61, which was Babes in Toyland from Disney and Pocket Full of Miracles from Capra. Hollywood just stopped making Christmas films really until I think A Christmas Story. I think it's the first like real Hollywood motion picture produced not for a TV channel film that is made about Christmas in that kind of 22-year gap.
Wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that gap in which that exists. But, you know, I was just talking to some scholars last night about Godzilla and these like these periods when Godzilla is high and people are producing. And right now there's a whole bunch of stuff like that. And then now, and you know, now it seems like it's, you know, when you talk about Hallmark films, which we all, you know, I love Hallmark Christmas movies. They're just awful.
We all
so
do.
Great, right?
They're so good. They're so good because they're so terrible, and they enjoy that. Like, they know what they are, and they don't try and pretend that they're not that. And we can all get behind that.
No, absolutely we can. We know when we're signing up. We're signing up for this very bland, often very, you know, just awkward at times, very conservative.
Extremely
right? Very
conservative.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Is it Lifetime that's the, or is it Hallmark that's the very Christian conservative channel of the two? I can't.
I mean, they both produce Christian conservative films. For sure, they both do. I would guess Lifetime is probably more so. I haven't seen a Lifetime film in a long time. I haven't lived in the US and I don't have access to them here. But I would guess that Lifetime is the more Christian leaning one.
Yeah, and now like Netflix and Amazon are explicitly making their own versions of these low budget, cruddy, crappy Christmas movies that I'm like, okay, yes, let's absolutely, because we'll show one here on the Sunday night thing that we do, Christmas on the Bayou or some nonsense.
Nice.
I love it, right? But so I came to you because I wanted to do a Christmas episode, which is this is kind of what we're doing here on the pod. And I knew you were doing history of Christmas films. I didn't know it was so dark and bleak, but I'm in on it now. I'm wearing all black. I'm wearing gray, whatever. But we kind of debated, it's like, what do you want to do, blah, blah, blah. And you said A Christmas Story. So why are we talking of all the Christmas movies out there, and there's a bazillion of them, why are we doing A Christmas Story?
Well, the true answer is that we both dislike it intensely. Oh so,
the word dislike does not do justice
it doesn't.
To
it
my
really
feelings
doesn't.
Towards this film.
I try not to say that I hate films because they are art. A lot of people put a lot of time and energy and passion and their art form into making these things. But my God, this film is really not my favorite. It's really, really not. I have a lot of just discomfort with a lot of the things in this film. Primarily, when is it set? Because we know it's 1940. They don't tell us it's 1940. But if you read anything about it, that says it's 1940. But there is nothing in this film that would tell you it is 1940 at all. Like, their time markers and touchstones are all over the place. The first scene with him looking in, with Ralphie looking into the toy shop window at Higbee's, we see like the radio flyer, which was introduced in like 1910s, and a Raggedy Ann doll, which is also 1910s. And then we see a Snow White kind of figure in the back. So that could be 1937 onwards. But then later on, we see a Mickey Mouse in the parade. And that costume was a debut costume in the late 1950s for Disneyland. So like, what? Where are we? And Scott Farkas is wearing a like coonskin cap, which could be fair enough, that's fine. But it is more likely just them throwing something in that looks older because the coonskin cap came into fashion with Disney's Davy Crockett. Like, kids were wearing that in the 50s because of the TV show, which definitely wasn't 1940. Like, the timestamps just everywhere in this film.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. This film is obviously based, you know, you've got the third person narrator. He's looking back on the film. The narration, mind you. I'll get you. I want to hear your thoughts on it because I hate it. I just hate it so much. There's so much. If you're coming to this pod thinking, oh, I love A Christmas Story, stop listening now. just don't listen anymore. I don't want to ruin your Christmas or your, you know, I do actually. You've got horrible taste in life. If you listen, if you like A Christmas Story, we're here to save you. This movie's clearly rooted in nostalgia, but it is all over the place.
So I think there's a fair thing to say about that. And I will try. I have a lot of things to say about this film that are not strictly negative. It is not my personal favorite. But I think like the timestamps all over the place can be interpreted as this idea that we don't really have a cultural idea of the 40s. Like, what do the 40s look like? Is there an aesthetic mainstream image of the 40s. I don't really think there is, at least not in the 80s. Like, there are other films. Spielberg has a World War II film that doesn't really feel like the 40s that also came out in the 80s. Like, there, we just don't really have an idea of how to construct that time space apart from kind of putting it in black and white. And that wasn't really an option for this film. They didn't want to do that. They wanted to make sure it felt like anyone's Christmas. So they kind of just took things that looked older, I think. And to be fair, that's how our mind works. That's how our memories work. So if we are going from a nostalgia standpoint, then this is just an exaggerated film of, he would be about 52 years old if he was 9 in 1940, and this, we take it at face value that it's 1983, then the narrator is 52 years old. If he's looking back like that, it makes sense that he would kind of import things from the 50s and be like, yeah, that kid definitely had a coonskin cap because that's what he remembers incorrectly, faulty memories, whatever. So we can forgive some of those things.
You know, as you were saying that, I was doing the math and I was like, wait a second, this film comes out in 83. It's reflecting back on 1940.
Oh yeah, no, don't
like
do
forever.
That math.
And I just did the math. If we make this movie today, it's in 1980. I'm 3. And I'm like, oh my God, am I that old? Like, and then I started to think about, okay, as you're talking, I'm like, how would I remember 1980? Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right, because all of this stuff from the childhood, like, yeah, it's you're absolutely right. It's forgivable that you would confuse something from, say, 1986 with something from like 1970 that came out in 78 or something like that, right? So it's like generally the ideas are there, I guess, you know? You were saying that there were parts of this film that you liked. Let's jump into that so that the people who are still here are like, we'll do the compliment sandwich.
Yes, okay.
That is a long delay, Vaughn.
I am really trying to think of something.
This is now an open-faced
positive
sandwich.
To say. It's just not for me. I like the general idea. Actually, I'll go with this. I really like the general idea that speaks to the genre of Christmas. That Christmas films are like the point of Christmas films and their kind of challenge. That is different from, I think, a lot of other films, is to speak to a personal, a local, a national, and an almost universal nostalgia all at once. So there is an idea of what Christmas is on an American national level. We have a firm idea of like Santa at Macy's, and he came in on the Thanksgiving parade, and you have a Christmas tree. There are gifts under the tree. Like there are specific kind of mainstays to Christmas, right? And a Christmas film has to speak to at least a couple of them to ground in with the audience that this is a Christmas film. So those are like the national level. And then there would be kind of regional things. So that would be the touchstone that it's not Macy's, it's Higbee's for people from Indiana. And like the dad saying, oh, that's another timestamp that's wrong, is the dad says that the White Sox have traded the Bullfrog, who is Bill Dietrich, and he is on the White Sox from 38 to 46. So again, where are we? But you get these local kind of things that kind of fix you in a location where you can go like, yeah, that was Christmas. Like, I do remember seeing Santa at Higbee's, or like, even if you didn't go, you have heard stories of other people having done that. And then there's this personal level of like, I wanted that gift for Christmas and I asked for it. And it's like this kind of universal experience of, I asked for it, I was told I wasn't going to get it. There was disappointment on Christmas morning, or there was the joy of actually getting the gift. And this film gives both of those options. So I think what is so successful about this film is that it speaks to the widest audience of universal experiences of Christmas while making it feel personal if you did have those experiences in a kind of funny, cathartic way that's rooted in that nostalgia of it not being 1983, it's 1940, and we can all have a fondness for like something so set in the past. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, this film has proven to be really a mainstay. I think it's on TBS yearly. I think they do a marathon every single year.
24 hours.
They continue to come back to this. And I wonder if that's just because it's so family friendly. It's, you know, this is not, you know, if you've got a family, this is a film that you can absolutely sit down. Most Christmas films are, I guess maybe the new one that came out, was it last year with, where Santa Claus is like killing all the mercenaries and stuff like that.
Oh, Violent Night.
Oh yeah. I haven't seen that yet. And I still
haven't seen that either.
I need to see it. But this is a movie where, you know, families can kind of sit around. And also, it's almost, you know, I kind of put this in my mind a lot like Wizard of Oz. And here's why. Like, this was a movie that I saw as a kid with my family when I was a child. And then as, you know, people are getting older and starting to have their own families, they're able to, like, maybe pass this on and kind of sit down and watch this, even kind of passively or something like that. And you were kind of getting in this idea of, like, these tropes. And I'm kind of wondering actually, before we even get into that, this idea, this film comes out in 83. You know, there's a moment in time when Christmas films aren't a thing. We think about them now. We can all name Elf or Grinch or this one or any number of things. You know, do we see an advent, a creation of the Christmas movie itself in Hollywood at any point in time? Or how do these things start to emerge?
This is such a contentious question among the, like, four people who study this.
Oh, yes.
So I would say no. I would say no, that this is not like the start of a thing. And I say that because I study Christmas films from an earlier period. Mm-hmm. But the fascinating thing about it is that this is the first one that really acknowledges in its marketing and in its title that it's a Christmas film. We do have earlier versions of A Christmas Carol for sure, but not... I think the last one would have been from Hollywood specifically, not the Alistair Sim one, which was 1951, but a British Lion production. The last Christmas Carol, I think, was probably in the 30s. And then we have other iterations of it, like It's a Wonderful Life, but that's a very different thing in the conversation. And even It's a Wonderful Life isn't really a Christmas film. That's quite a contentious thing.
Shots fired.
It's, I mean, it starts and ends my dissertation, so it is... It is, but it also can be interpreted as not being that. And I mean, it's art. Art can be anything you want. But the most fascinating thing about Christmas films, I think, is that it's not a genre and it's never been a genre, is something that I argue, because it's just tropes. It's a subgenre that can be applied to other genres. Like Die Hard is a Christmas film, but it's an action film first. Or like Gremlins is a thriller / horror Christmas film. Or, like, you have all of these Hallmark rom-coms that are also Christmas films. Like, you apply the Christmas tropes onto genres that already exist and make it into another thing. So I would say that. But to answer the question that you actually asked, I think you could probably say that this is the start of Hollywood actually acknowledging, like, oh, there's really a market for this. We could really do something with this, but we were still in the Cold War. We still had tensions with how to approach Christmas. Hollywood had not made a Christmas film for about 22 years before A Christmas Story came out. So they were still kind of finding their footing, figuring out how to do this. And I don't think they really hit their stride until Disney re-enters the scene in 1990 with The Santa Claus and starts. I've called the 90s everything but the kitchen sink, I think, before, because because Disney really like reinvents the whole system of like, we can do low budget, mid budget and high budget. We'll have some blockbusters. We'll have some that go to cinemas for a week. And then we will have some that go straight to home video, straight to VHS. And that was how they worked. So they were just pumping out films all over the place. And there were Christmas films at every level of that for Disney. Like we had the Santa Claus, and then Jingle All the Way was kind of a mid-budget film. And then like Beauty and the Beast 2, Belle's Enchanted Christmas. Like you have Hollywood kind of hit a stride with Christmas, I think, in the 90s. After there was this kind of experimental period in the 80s with A Christmas Story and the super violent ones that I'm blanking on the names of. And then you have Gremlins in 84. You have Scrooged in 88. Die Hard's also 88. You have National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation is at some point in there. I don't remember when. But that's kind of an experimental phase of like, how do we actually do this? And then Disney, because they're Disney and they dominate everything, they just come in 1990 and they're like, we will show you.
Yeah, there's, you know, I guess maybe unsurprisingly, there's a very capitalistic bent to Christmas films, right? Once these studios are clearly picking out, there's money to be made on Christmas. I know, this is shocking, right? But then, you know, you're absolutely reminding me of, like, my little sister had the VHS tapes, you know, of everything. Mm-hmm. And then there were almost always some variation of, like, and I'm just making stuff up here now, but like 101 Dalmatians Christmas or some variant of the cartoon that you like with a Christmas
show.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And you could pick that up on. You're talking about these tropes, and this is kind of a weird movie, this Christmas Story, because it's, you know, it's really just kind of rooted in this one kid's desire for this gun, but it's got these weird little, I don't know even what to call them, little segments in there that don't really have anything to do with the plot, where he's just kind of riffing on some kid getting his tongue stuck to a thing. Can you speak a little bit to the ideas of, like, what makes a Christmas movie, even though we say they don't exist? Like, what are we looking for in your classic Christmas films? And how much of that do we see in A Christmas Story?
It's a good question. And I think the largest one that this really speaks to is nostalgia. Nostalgia is an incredibly important part of Christmas films. And that is, like, the main thrust of a Christmas film is to make you go back to a time where you felt safe and happy and comfortable. And you had these desires and wishes and everything was innocent and pure. Like, that is the foundation of almost every Christmas film. That isn't an action or a horror or one of those. And this film does that really well. So, like, those little segments in between, like, I would call them vignettes, the kind of scenes between scenes where it's just this kid kind of living his life and going through a few weeks leading up to Christmas and the funny things that are happening as he remembers it. And that really comes from the book that this is based on. What is it? In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash.
Mm-hmm.
So that was written by the person narrating, Gene Shepherd, who was a radio broadcaster and performer, comedian for many decades in the U.S. And that book is like 33 chapters of vignettes. I think it's 33. It's over 30 chapters, but it's like a very small book. So it's just these like kind of rapid fire funny moments that he remembers looking back on his childhood. And that was written in 1966 and not specifically about like this story. This is just like a few chapters A Christmas Story is. And then there's actually like, I bet a lot of people who like this film don't know that it is a franchise and that there are several other films built around the
Parker
family.
This is the third of the group, right?
I think this is the first, or this is the second. There was one in 75, one in 83, and one in 94, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, it's part of a franchise, which is really interesting because we don't really have that many franchises in the late 20th century. That felt gross to say.
There are so many professors right now I've seen like talking about. There's a meme going around recently where someone was asking if they could like quote something from the late 20th century from like 1994. And the person was just like, I died. Listeners, I died just now, right? I want to talk actually about your research because I think it's really, really cool, your entry point here in talking about this very specific era in film history and how you know the government is kind of shaping these films and things like that. So maybe you can talk about the history of these films during the time period when you're talking about these and kind of maybe kind of guide us through your maybe for those of us who haven't read your book yet, which will be you know at some point in time, right? But take us through what you're working on and why it's important for us to know.
Thank you. My dissertation, it, like I said, starts in 46, ends in 61. And I start with looking at why the FBI named It's a Wonderful Life as communist subversion. And like, what is this moment of fear that the FBI has an office in Hollywood and they're writing these secret reports about films as potential subversion? And why It's a Wonderful Life is in there, because it is not communist. Like, it's about two bankers. Like, it is such a capitalist film, but it was too communist because Ayn Rand said it was, and the FBI went with that. So, fine. that report was published in August 1947. In September 1947, we have HUAC issue subpoenas for the Hollywood 10. The House Committee on Un-American Activities issued subpoenas for 10 directors, producers, and writers in Hollywood, alleging that they were communists, and asked them to testify in October 47. They refused and were held in contempt of Congress. And in November 47, the Hollywood elites met at the Waldorf Astoria on November 18th and issued the Waldorf Statement, which introduced the blacklist to Hollywood. So that's a lot of very rapid changes right then. And then in 1948, the Supreme Court ruled after really 30 years of various antitrust problems in Hollywood. The Supreme Court ruled that all of the studios had to, all of the main eight studios had to sell their cinemas, and that caused a financial kind of tumble in Hollywood. So what my dissertation does is looks at all of those things happening in this very short period, and the fact that HUAC stayed from 47 to 52 in Hollywood, had two rounds of hearings, and it all just caused so much havoc within Hollywood, and so much fear, and so much pressure, and so much suspicion, that filmmakers really struggled to make the films that they wanted to make. So they either buried their true messages even further, and there's a lot of subversive messaging that isn't communist, but it is buried messaging within 50s films. That's fascinating to rip out and see what you can get out of these films, what you can interpret out of one line. There's so much creative stuff in 50s films, but there's also a huge increase in romance films and comedies, kind of unserious films. And we also see a massive decline in social problem and psychological films in that period. And that has a huge impact on the kind of lighter fare that you would go for. So what I wanted to do was, as I said earlier, look at an innocuous genre. Look at films where you think you're just having a fun time, like White Christmas. You think you're just having a fun time, but that is a film that's heavily about criticizing the U.S. military as it operated in Korea. And challenging the idea of covert warfare in favor of what nostalgically is this more gentleman's warfare of World War II. Like, those are really interesting messages that are buried into numbers, what can you do with a general? Like, what it's a song and dance film, but it's also extremely fascinating kind of wartime criticism and propaganda at the same time. And there are other films in this period that are just absolutely kind of vacant of real criticism or engagement with the period at all. Like Pocketful of Miracles is Capra's last film, and he was kind of forced to make this film that was a direct remake of Lady for a Day from 1933, and he didn't update it at all for the modern era, and it ended his career. Just completely, he never made another film, and he walked away from Hollywood because of the pressures from the producers that were so out of touch, so wildly out of touch with what the audience wanted and what the filmmakers wanted to do. And it comes from this period of the government stepping in and really kind of fucking shit up.
Wow. I had no idea that any of this, I think about the period and I think about the era. And of course, those who were familiar with HUAC and so forth, but I never thought that it would apply also to Christmas films, which had always kind of seemed as a benign, kind of happy-go-lucky kind of thing. Like you said, and maybe that's because when I think about Christmas movies, I'm also seeing them through a lens of nostalgia, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think about Christmas films and I'm thinking about how I felt when I watched them with whomever, right? My mom, my mom, if I go to my mom's house, she's got, the Bumble from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer all over the house, right? Because I think that what comes out, 58, 59-ish?
64.
64. Okay, so my mom was born in 59. So yeah, so that's her childhood, that's her childhood memory. And so now I see that through there. And it's it's difficult in some ways to like look at these things critically when you grow up with this nostalgic imagery.
Yeah, it really is. And that's such a fascinating thing about Christmas films, I think, because they're unlike any other genre. People save them for one time a year. Like, you don't watch these films normally all year round. And it's something that you put on when you are doing something else. Like, most of the time you're baking cookies or wrapping presents, like you have this film on in the background and you're just like, oh, ha ha ha. Like every time a bell rings, like, you know, these lines, but you don't really think about what am I watching? What messages am I receiving? And I personally think it's an incredibly important thing for us to be able to parse the media that we are watching, especially even more so when it is innocuous or something where you're not expecting political messages. And also questioning what we mean by political. Like, all of these films have an average American, and it's like, okay, what does average American mean though? And why aren't we breaking that down more? It's so frequently white, like all the goddamn time. So, or middle class, or like it's very uncommon that the ideas in these films are actually universal, but they feel universal. And that's the kind of fascinating thing about Christmas films, is that like they occupy this space in our lives where we don't want to critically engage with them. And there are other types of media like that, or other types of media where you just don't have the media literacy skills to be able to parse those things, like we are seeing with the kind of advent of news entertainment, or entertainment news, however you want to say it, and not having those skills to really parse out, like, what am I taking in right now? Like, can I trust what I'm watching here? All of that kind of stuff. And then the other kind of point that I'll bring it back to A Christmas Story for this is your point on nostalgia. That is a huge reason for why this is a successful film. And I think for each generation, it really, this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently, especially for each generation of Americans, we've had our own kind of troubles. And A Christmas Story is set in 1940, before the atomic bomb was made. And it's a period where there's a sense of safety for Americans. There is no actual like pressure or trouble or cynicism in this film, apart from like, oh, he has a grumpy dad and there's a bully, but he beats the bully and it's fine. And his dad gives him the gift anyway. So it's all fine. Everything works out. There's no existential kind of dread in this film. And it came out in 1983, which was one of the most, like, one of the hottest years of the Cold War, or whatever, however you want to term it. There was the false alarm launch in 1983. Like, that, like,
that's goddamn terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Like, it's a period of fucking tension. Like, you're afraid again. And then you get this film that feels like everything is safe. Everything is happy. Like, this is great. And then every generation after, when you're showing it to your kids, it's like, oh, like 9/11, or like the Iraq War, or like, is Russia going to use nukes again? Like, I think it's a very American thing to go back to 1940 and be like, that was the sweet spot. That was when it was good.
Vaughn, I can't help it. You're talking about this Reagan era stuff here. I really think you're on, like, this is, you're absolutely onto this, because it's like, I'm thinking, but this film comes out 83. Mm-hmm. You get Reagan's It's Morning Again
in Morning America Again in America. Yes.
1980, like the very next year. And clearly building off of these ideas of this innocent America built around, frankly, this white nuclear family. Mm-hmm. And everything is safe and good. And in Indiana, the most – it's the heartland, right? It's the Midwest. That's not a surprise, even though everyone who's listened to this podcast knows that Indiana is the ninth circle of hell. So I would trade anything for Indiana. I would trade a jar of pickles for Indiana. You know, Pickles are great, by the way, unless they're bread and butter, then no. But either way, like, there's got to be, I mean, there's got to be something to this, this idea of, like, reconstructing America, the image of America during the height of the Cold War under Reaganism. This is like, exactly what Reaganism's wanting us to see, is it not?
Yeah, and it also just works with what Hollywood's doing at the time. Like, Back to the Future comes out the next year. Mm-hmm. Like, we have this obsession with going backwards. This is something that I want to write my postdoc or next book on, actually, is this idea of extreme nostalgia or nostalgic extremism, where in these moments of serious strife, we get time travel films or films set in the past or films set in the future. Like, it's a film to escape the moment and either be like, look, there is still a future, which is what you got in the 60s with the Jetsons, when we were going through like Cuban Missile Crisis and like JFK assassination. The Jetsons comes out and it looks like your contemporary moment, or like Kubrick, 2001 A Space Odyssey, even though that's a thriller kind of thing. It's the idea that there is a future and all of the appliances look like yours and all of the things that you're used to are going to be in that future. So you're going to be safe. Or it's going backwards and being like, remember that time when we all felt safe and there was this unified moment and the biggest problem was that there was a bully on your way home from school. Like, that kind of political moment of extreme conservatism especially really breeds this kind of counterculture in Hollywood films of like, what would it be like to get out of this moment, to not be here right now? What else can we imagine? And you also get an uptick of sci-fi films in those periods, like that aren't strictly time travel, but just other kind of sci-fi things. And I think it's fascinating.
I keep thinking about this in terms of some guy who gets dumped and he keeps waiting for the phone to call. And all his friends are saying, she's not going to call, bro. Mm. It's like that time period is gone. And it's like, yeah, we're kind of reliving in the past here. And you see that, right? You're absolutely, you know, Back to the Future's harkening back to 55, obviously. And these places are safe and good as long as you're white. These are not good places to be if you are any other American in the United States. And that's the underlying thing. It's like, we only see this, like, this glimpse of this happy Americana that's really kind of packaged, Rockwellian, kind of sold to us through pop culture, right?
Yeah, and there's also this element of, this is something else that we can kind of excuse the time jumping, especially with like the Mickey Mouse thing projected back in A Christmas Story, that it's from a 15-year difference. Like, there's also this idea as part of what I'm working on with that other project that you bring part of your moment back with you. So like in Back to the Future, when he sings...
Would Johnny Be Good?
Yes, thank you. When he sings that in 55 and he says, oh, but your kids are going to love it. Like, that's the idea that like, we can look back and be like, that moment was better. Like, the 50s were better, but they're only the best if we bring us with it. And we put ourselves into that period as we are. And it's this kind of like marriage between these two time periods where you're really saying like, I wish that was the moment right now with all of our cool shit, but just better like it was in the 50s is the idea then. Of course, that's a challenging idea. But I think we get that in A Christmas Story too, with him looking back and being like, these are the good things from my childhood, like all over the place. Let's just pick these things out and put them all into 1940, where I felt safest and happiest and got the gift I always wanted and whatnot.
And you had said something earlier about the idea of putting this on in the background. I meant to come back to this. I had never considered the idea of watching these films as part of a performance of Christmas. Right. Yeah. The idea is like you're only watching this really probably from Thanksgiving on here in the States. You know, I wonder what the relationship to Christmas is in the UK, you know, because it's not rooted around the idea of an American Thanksgiving or like, you know, here in the States, we can't listen to Christmas music until Thanksgiving is over with, you know, or at least until November 1st, I guess, might be stretching it. But, you know, there's definitely a difference there. And I had never really thought of like, oh, I do this when I'm doing that. Mm-hmm. I can put this on and not pay attention to it. but it's safe and it puts me in a spirit. It's almost like a drug that you kind of put in to put yourself in a particular space and time of, you know, while you're doing whatever else, lights, whatever.
It's like a shot of nostalgia. It makes the moment, it puts on the atmosphere. It's like putting on an album or like, I don't know, like lighting a candle or something. It's changing the ambiance of a space to make it more Christmassy. And it's pretty rare to find someone who does celebrate Christmas who doesn't have a film that they watch every year.
Right.
Like that is a rare thing, whether it's like Christmas Eve or Christmas Day or like week of, like almost everybody who celebrates the holiday, who is American, I'll really emphasize that American, has a film that they are tied to that it's like, when I watch that, it's Christmas.
All right. Okay. That lends perfectly to what I want to talk about next, because last night I tweeted out, I tagged you in the tweet. It's like, hey, what are your favorite Christmas movies? Right. And people just gave us a slew of them. I saw that you were commenting on some of the thoughts. Mm-hmm. Vaughn, if I want to say, hey, what are the best Christmas movies? Like, do you have a thought in your mind as far as when you talk about Christmas movies or like, what is it? Best kind of goes person to person, right?
But yeah.
What are the iconic Christmas movies? As someone who has studied this kind of stuff, what are the movies that are really in that cultural lexicon that really kind of identify what Christmas movies kind of are and should be?
Well, should be is a that's a fraught one.
Should be? Okay, maybe are. Then.
Yeah. So I think the top three that anyone would recognize would be It's a Wonderful Life, Home Alone, and Miracle on 34th Street. I think those are the top three that people come to first. And then you have your other ones of like The Grinch. Somebody inevitably starts the Die Hard debate when you ask this question. Muppet's Christmas Carol is
huge. We did that a few years ago.
Gigantic film. It kind of blows my mind how loved that film is. Like, I get it. It's great. It's really good. But it really, like, how does it have the cultural space that it does? It's like Taylor Swift. Like, it's the Taylor Swift of Christmas films. I'll go on record saying that. It just captures people in such a way. Really, really, Michael Caine is the Taylor Swift of Christmas films. But yeah, it captures this incredible cross-section of people also, where just everybody has some sort of association or fascination with Muppet's Christmas Carol. I think those are the main ones. Probably also you could throw in Love Actually.
We just did that a couple of weeks ago on HATM, and people were just like losing their minds. There were so many people who had never seen it. They were like, some were like, this is creepy and stalky. You shouldn't do this.
Yes.
In that film, right? But Bill Nye.
Oh, he's perfect. He's a perfect man.
Oh my
man.
Gosh. Have you ever seen About Time?
Yes, I have. And it makes me cry every single time.
Oh my God. He's so wonderful in that
film. It's so good.
Any chance I have to talk about Rachel McAdams is an okay time for me, but that's fine. We'll leave that there. That's well established by now. But Bill Nye and was it Domhnall Gleeson is it's so good. Can we have the debate about Die Hard?
Yeah.
Is it a Christmas film?
It is. It is. In my professional opinion. So there are a lot of ways.
You're our first Christmas scholar. You're setting the tone here. No, so
there are.
We're going full on.
None others. No, that's not true. There are about like five. There are lots of ways that you can categorize a Christmas film, and people will debate this till the end of time. And my ultimate answer is a Christmas film is whatever the fuck you want it to be, because it doesn't matter. If it's a film that you watch at Christmas and you have a personal nostalgic connection to it and it's part of your Christmas tradition, it's a Christmas film. Like, people over here watch The Great Escape as a Christmas film.
What?
It's a Christmas film here. And I'm like, whatever floats your boat. Like, fine.
People were saying that last time. Does that occur on Christmas?
I don't know. I've only seen it once. But
okay.
I
Steve McQueen, I guess.
It like or Sound of Music is a popular Christmas film.
Okay.
Like,
yeah, well, the song, right?
Yeah, I guess. But that's the thing is, like, It counts as a Christmas film if you watch it at Christmas, and you count it as a Christmas film. The other kind of more technical terminology kind of ways that you could do it is looking at, is it set at Christmas? Is there a Christmas spirit to it? Or is Christmas an integral part of the plot? And for Die Hard, I say it is, because it would be fucking weird for him to fly across the country to go to an office party for his wife if it wasn't Christmas. Like, that's the one time of year that that's kind of a socially acceptable thing that you, like, he's going back to, like,
if you're making a play for your wife, you're going to that party.
Yeah, he's trying to rekindle their marriage and, like, save their marriage because they're estranged. If he rocked up at any other time of year to her office...
Weird.
like weird. This film doesn't work if that's the thing. And also, like, the hostage situation there is because it is Christmas and, like, certain things are offline, or, like, they have reduced staff at, like, the police station. Like, there were reasons for that that were around Christmas. And the film doesn't work if it's not Christmas. So that is my reasoning for it being a Christmas film.
And isn't the brilliance, one of the brilliance of that film as you were talking, I was just thinking, the idea that Christmas music is so interlaced with an action film where people are shooting each other with machine guns, it's so antithetical, and it just works. That film just works, you know? There's another film just like that, though, but it's not a Christmas movie. Lethal Weapon is a movie set around Christmas time, but I don't think Christmas is an important aspect. Christmas is not driving a Lethal Weapon, is it?
I don't think I've ever seen Lethal Weapon.
Oh my goodness. Now we've got a new part. No. This was back before it was weird to, like, watch a Mel Gibson.
Yeah, that's, you know, what
it's like, oh, damn it, Mel. Yeah. Why do you have to be awful? It's just such good stuff. And then all right. We're all kind of working our way towards this final question here, Vaughn. So, as you, preeminent Christmas scholar, Christmas film scholar in the world, we know Christmas Story is a Christmas movie, if Christmas movies exist. Mm-hmm. But is it a history film?
Yeah. No, like 100% it is, because it's leaning into that nostalgia, as I was saying, for 1940 and pre-bomb, and what does America look like in this kind of alternate world that we can imagine of 1940. And really, the 1940 that we see, as I've said a couple times, is not 1940 as it was. It's 1940 as remembered by people in the 80s, or imagined by people in the 80s, or interpreted by people in the 80s, which is what, like, history is all about, is reinterpreting those moments and incorporating a modern perspective as part of your analysis of it. And I think this film is very much about that.
Awesome. Vaughn, where can people find you online and elsewhere when they're in the Yuletide spirit?
I am on Twitter and Blueski. I think both of them are at G Vaughn Joy. I am on Substack. That's where I am.
Oh, yes.
I have a newsletter called Review Roulette, which I do a film review weekly from a different theoretical or analytical lens, a random one each week. So that has been fun.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And that's a wrap here at Historia to the Movies podcast. Thank you so much to our guest, Vaughn Joy, for coming in to talk about this movie. Vaughn, I had the best time talking to you. I think your work is absolutely amazing. I cannot wait to see it in its final form. I think it was absolutely amazing. And thank you, of course, to our intrepid producer, Fletcher Powell, for making this podcast operate. Fletch, you are the gift that keeps on giving. And guys, I'm so sorry you have to listen to that nonsense. But guys, thank you so, so very much for being part of this Historians of Movies community. Thank you for being here. I hope that you are enjoying some really happy and healthy holidays. I hope that whatever faith you practice, if you don't practice faith, whatever it is, I hope that you are around people who love you. Hope you know that you are loved here. Thank you for continuing to share this podcast with your friends and families and telling everyone about it. Thank you for being part of this community. So that's the last pod before Christmas. I hope that you have a Merry Christmas And we will see you, we'll see you next week for another pod. Dungeons & Dragons is up right before the new year, so I hope you're ready for that one. It's a dragon-sized episode that is still being edited right now because it's so big, but it's a really cool episode. So anyway, guys, thank you so much for being here, being part of this. You just mean the world to me. So hope you're well, and that's all for now.